Chapter 19 of The Country Beyond. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Country Beyond by James Oliver Curwood. Chapter 19. In the star dusk of evening, the time came when he spoke his fears to Father John. Nada had gone into her room, taking Peter with her. And out under the cool of the skies, Father John's pale face was turned up to the unending glory of the firmament, and his lips were whispering a prayer of gratitude and blessing, when Roger laid a hand gently on his arm. "Father," he said, "it is a wonderful night."
"A night of gladness and omen," replied Father John. "See the stars. They seem to be alive and rejoicing. And it is not sacrilege to believe they are giving you their benediction."
"And yet I am afraid."
"Afraid?"
Father John looked into his eyes and saw him staring off over the forest tops. "Yes, afraid for her." Briefly he told him of what had happened on the Barren months ago, and how he had narrowly escaped Breault in coming away from the burned country.
"He is on my trail," he said, "and tonight he is not very far away."
The missioner's hand rested in a comforting way on his arm.
"You did not kill Jed Hawkins, my son, and for that we have thanked God each day and night of our lives, Nada and I. And each evening she has prayed for you, kneeling at my side, and through every hour of the day I know she was praying for you in her heart. And I believe in the answer to prayer such as that, Roger. Her faith now is as deep as the sea. And you, too, must have faith."
"She is more precious to me than life, a thousand lives if I had them," whispered Jolly Roger. "If anything should happen now..."
"Yes, if the thing you fear should happen, what then?" cried Father John, faith ringing like a note of inspiration in his low voice. "What then, Roger? You did not kill Jed Hawkins. If the law compels you to pay a price for the errors it believes you have committed, will that price be so terribly severe?"
"Prison, Father. Probably 5 years."
Father John laughed softly, the star glow revealing a radiance in his face. "5 years," he repeated. "Oh, my boy, my dear boy! What are 5 years to pay for such a treasure as that which has come into your possession tonight? 5 short years. Only 5. And she waiting for you, proud of you for those very achievements which sent you to prison, planning for all the future that lies beyond those 5 short years, growing sweeter and more beautiful for you as she waits. Roger, is that a very great sacrifice? Is it too great a price to pay? 5 years, and after that, peace, love, happiness for all time? Is it, Roger?"
McKay felt his voice tremble as he tried to answer. "But she, Father..."
"Yes, yes, I know what you would say," interrupted Father John gently. "I argued with her, just as you would have argued, Roger. I appealed to her reason. I told her that if you returned, it would mean prison for you, and strangely, I said that same thing, 5 years. But I found her selfish, Roger, very selfish, and set upon her desire beyond all reason. And it was she who asked first those very questions I have asked you tonight. 'What are 5 years?' she demanded of me, defying my logic. 'What are 5 years, or 10, or 20? If I know I am to have him after that.' Yes, she was selfish, Roger. Just that great is her love for you."
"Dear God in heaven!" breathed Jolly Roger, and stopped, his eyes staring wide at the stars.
"And after that, after I had given in to her selfishness, Roger, she planned how we, she and I, would live very near to the place where they imprisoned you, and how each day some sight or sign should pass between you and the baby."
"The baby, Father?"
Thus it seems she dreams, Roger. She, in the willfulness of her desire and selfishness." With a choking cry, Roger bowed his face in his hands. For a moment Father John was silent. And then he said, so very low that it was almost a whisper, "I have passed many years in the wilderness, Roger, many years trying to look into the hearts of people and of God. And this love of Nada's, is the greatest of all the miracles I have witnessed in a life that is now reaching to its 65. Do you see the wonder of it, son? And does it make you happy and fearless now?" He did not wait for an answer, but turned slowly and went in the direction of the cabin, leaving Roger alone under the thickening stars. And McKay's face was like Father John's, filled with a strange and wonderful radiance when he looked up. But with that light of happiness was also the fiercer underglow of a great determination. For Nada, for the baby, the worst should not happen. He breathed the thought aloud, and in the words was a prayer that God might help him and make unnecessary the sacrifice from which Father John had taken the sting of fear. And yet, if that sacrifice came, he saw clearly now that it would not be a great tragedy, but only a brief shadow cast over the undying happiness in his soul. For they, Nada and the baby, would be waiting, waiting. Suddenly he was conscious of a sound very near, and he beheld Nada, taller and slimmer and more beautiful than ever, it seemed to him, in the starlight. "I have told him," Father John had whispered to her only a moment before. "I have told him so that he will not fear prison, either for himself or for you." And she had come to him quietly, all of the pretty triumph and playfulness gone, so that she stood like an angel in the soft glow of the skies, much older than he had ever seen her before, and smiled at him with a new and wonderful tenderness as she held out her hands to him. Not until she lay in his arms, looking up at him from under her long lashes, did he dare to speak. And then, "Is it true what Father John has told me?" he asked.
"It is true,"
she whispered, and the silken lashes covered her eyes. Her hand crept up to his face in the silence that followed, and rested there. And with no desire to hear more than the three words she had spoken, he crushed his lips in the sweet coils of her hair, and together, in that peace and understanding, they listened to the gentle whisperings of the night.
"Roger,"
she whispered at last.
"Yes, my Neewa." "What does that mean, Roger?"
"It means beloved, wife."
"Then I like it. But I shall like the others, one of the others, best."
"My wife."
That makes me happiest, Roger. Your wife.
Oh, it is the sweetest word in the world. That and—" He felt her warm face hide itself softly against his neck.
"Mother,"
he added.
"Yes, mother,"
she repeated after him in an odd little voice. "Oh, I have dreamed of mother since I have been old enough to dream, Roger. My mother. I never had one that I can remember, except in a dream.
It must be wonderful to have a mother, Roger."
"And yet, I think not quite so wonderful as to be a mother, my Nada."
"Listen,"
she whispered.
"It is the leaf bud singing."
"A love song?"
"Yes, in Cree."
She raised her head so that her eyes were wide open and looking at him.
"Since we came up here, all this wonderful world has been promising song for me, Roger. And since you came back to me, it has been singing, singing, singing every hour of night and day. Have you ever dreamed of leaving it, Roger, of going down into that world of towns and cities of which Father John has told me so much?"
"Would you like to go there, Nada?"
"Only to look upon it and come away. I want to live in the forests where I found you, always and always, Roger." She raised herself on tiptoe and kissed him. "I want to live near Yellowbird and Suncloud. Please, Mr. Jolly Roger, I do. And Father John will go with us. And we'll be so happy there all together, Yellowbird and Suncloud and Giselle and I. Oh!" His arms had tightened so suddenly that the little cry came from her. "And yet I may have to leave you for a little time, Nada. But it will not be for long. What are 5 years, when all life reaches out a paradise before us? They are nothing, nothing, and will pass swiftly." "Yes, they will pass swiftly," she said, so gently that scarce did he hear. But on his breast she gave a little sob which could not choke itself back, a sob which bravely she smiled through a moment later, and which he, knowing that it was best, made as if he had not heard. And so this night, while Father John and Peter waited and watched in the cabin, did they plan their future in the company of the stars. End of Chapter 19. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 20 of The Country Beyond. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Country Beyond by James Oliver Curwood. Chapter 20. The Sabbath was a day of glory and peace in the Burntwood country. The sun rose warm and golden, the birds were singing, and never had the air seemed sweeter to Father John when he came out quietly from the cabin and breathed it in the early break of dawn. Best of all, he loved this very beginning of day, before darkness was quite gone, when the world seemed to be awakening mid sleepy whisperings, and sounds came clearly from a long distance. This morning he heard the barking of a dog, a mile away it must have been, and Peter, who followed close behind him, pricked up his ears at the sound of it. Father John had noted Peter's vigilance, the cautious expectancy with which he was always sniffing the air, and the keen alertness of his eyes and ears. McKay had explained the reason for it. And this morning, as they made their way down to the pool at the creekside, Peter's ceaseless watching for danger held a deeper significance for Father John. All through the night, in spite of his faith and his words of consolation, he was thinking of the menace which was following McKay, and which eventually must catch up with him. And yet, how short a time was 5 years! Looking backward, each 5 years of his life seemed but a yesterday. It was 8 times 5 years ago that a sweet-faced girl had first filled his life, as Nada filled Jolly Roger's now, and through the 30 years since he had lost her, he could still hear her voice as clearly as though he had held her in his arms only a few hours ago, so swift had been the passing of time. But looking ahead, and not backward, 5 years seemed an eternity of time, and the dread of it was in Father John's heart as he stood at the side of the pool, with the first pink glow of sunrise coming to him over the forest tops. 5 years, and he was an old man now. A long and dreary wait it would be for him. But for youth, the glorious youth of Roger and Nada, it would seem very short when in later years they looked back upon it. And for a time, as he contemplated the long span of life that lay behind him, and the briefness of that which lay ahead, a yearning selfishness possessed the soul of Father John, an almost savage desire to hold those 5 years away from the violation of the law, not alone for Nada's sake and Roger McKay's, but for his own. In this twilight of a tragic life, a great happiness had come to him in the love of these two, and thought of its menace, its desecration by a pitiless and mistaken justice, roused in him something that was more like the soul of a fighting man than the spirit of a missioner of God. Vainly he tried to stamp out the evil of this resentment, for evil he believed it to be. And shame possessed him when he saw the sweet glory in Nada's face later that morning, and the happiness that was in Roger McKay's. Yet was that aching place in his heart,
and the hidden fear which he could not vanquish. And that day, it seemed to him, his lips gave voice to lies. For being Sunday, the wilderness folk gathered from miles about, and he preached to them in the little mission house which they had helped him to build of logs in the clearing. Partly he spoke in Cree, and partly in English, and his message was one of hope and inspiration, pointing out the silver linings that always lay beyond the darkness of clouds. To McKay, holding Nada's hand in his own as they listened, Father John's words brought a great and comforting faith. And in Nada's eyes and voice, as she led in Cree the song, "Nearer, my God, to thee," he heard and saw the living fire of that faith, and had Breault come in through the open doorway then, he would have accepted him calmly as the beginning of that sacrifice which he had made up his mind to make. In the afternoon, when the wilderness people had gone, Father John heard again the story of Yellow Bird, for Nada was ever full of questions about her, and for the first time the missioner learned of the inspiration which the Indian woman's sorcery had been to Jolly Roger. "It was foolish," McKay apologized, in spite of the certainty and faith which he was shining in Nada's eyes. "But it helped me."
"It wasn't foolish," replied Nada quickly. "Yellow Bird did come to me, and she knew."
"No true faith is folly," said Father John, in his soft, low voice. "The great fact is that Yellow Bird believed. She was inspired by a great confidence, and confidence and faith give to the mind a power which it is utterly incapable of possessing without them. I believe in the mind, children. I believe that in some day to come it will reach those heights where it will unlock the mystery of life itself to us. I have seen many strange things in my 40-odd years in the wilderness, and not the least of these have been the achievements of the primitive mind, and it seems to me, Roger, that Yellow Bird told you much that has come true. And has it occurred to you—" He stopped, knowing that the cloud of unrest which was almost fear in his heart was driving him to say these things.
"What, Father?" questioned Nada, bending toward him.
"I was about to express a thought which suggests an almost childish curiosity, and you will laugh at me, my dear. I am wondering if it has occurred to Roger the mysterious country beyond of which Yellow Bird dreamed might be the great country down there, south, beyond the border. The United States?" Something which he could not control seemed to drive the words from his lips, and in an instant he saw that Nada had seized upon their significance. Her eyes widened. The blue in them grew darker, and Roger observed her fingers grip suddenly in the softness of her dress as she turned from Father John to look at him.
"Or it might be China, or Africa, or the South Seas," he tried to laugh, remembering his old visions. "It might be anywhere."
Nada's lips trembled as if she were about to speak, and then very quietly she sat, with her hands tightly clasped in her lap, and Father John knew she was not expressing the thought in her heart when she said,
"Some day I want to tell Yellow Bird how much I love her."
Now in these hours since he and his master had come to the burnt wood, it seemed to Peter that he had lost something very great, for in his happiness McKay had taken but scant notice of him, and Nada seemed to have found a greater joy than that which a long time ago she had found in his comradeship. So now, as she saw him lying in his loneliness a short distance away, Nada suddenly ran to him, and together they went into the thick screen of the balsams, Peter yipping joyously, and Nada without so much as turning her head in the direction of Roger and Father John. But even in that bird-like swiftness with which she had left them, Father John had caught the look in her eyes.
"I have made a mistake," he confessed humbly. "I have sinned, because in her I have roused the temptation to urge you to fly away with her, down there, south. She is a woman, and being a woman she has infinite faith in Yellow Bird, for Yellow Bird helped to give you to her. She believes—" "And I also believe," said McKay, staring at the green balsams. "And yet it is better for you to remain. God means that judgment and happiness should come in their turn."
Jolly Roger rose to his feet, facing the south.
"It is a temptation, Father. It would be hard to give her up now. If Breault would only wait a little while. But if he comes now..."
He walked away slowly, following through the balsams where Nada and Peter had gone. Father John watched him go, and a trembling smile came to his lips when he was alone. In his heart he knew he was a coward, and that these young people had been stronger than he. For in their happiness and the faith which he had falsely built up in them, they had resigned themselves to the inevitable, while he, in these moments of cowardice, had shown them the way to temptation. And yet, as he stood there, looking in the direction they had gone, he felt no remorse because of what he had done, and a weight seemed to have lifted itself from his shoulders. For a time the more selfish instincts of the man rose in him, fighting down the sacrificial humility of the great faith of which he was a messenger. The new sensation thrilled him, and in its thrill he felt his heart beating a little faster, and hope rising in him. 5 years were a long time, for him. That was the thought which kept repeating itself over and over in his brain, and with it came that other thought, that self-preservation was the first law of existence, and therefore could not be a sin. Thus did Father John turn traitor to his spoken words, though his calm and smiling face gave no betrayal of it when Nada and Roger returned to the cabin an hour later, their arms filled with red bakneesh vines and early wildflowers. Nada's cheeks were as pink as the bakneesh, and her eyes as blue as the rock violets she wore on her breast. And Father John knew that Jolly Roger was no longer oppressed by the fear of a menace which he was helpless to oppose, for there was something very confident in the look of his eyes, and the manner in which they rested upon Nada. Peter alone saw the mysterious thing which happened in the early evening. He was with Nada in her room, and she was the old Nada again, hugging his shaggy head in her arms, and whispering to him in the old excited way. And strange memory of a bundle came back to Peter, for very quietly, as if unseen ears might be listening to her, Nada gathered many things in a pile on the table, and made another bundle. This bundle she thrust under her bed, just as a long time ago she had thrust a similar bundle under a banksian clump in the meadowland below Cragg's Ridge. Father John went to his bed very early, and he was thinking of Breault. The Hudson's Bay Company post was only 12 miles away, and Breault would surely go there before questing from cabin to cabin for his victim. So it happened that a little after midnight he rose without making a sound, and by the light of a candle wrote a note for Nada, saying he had business at the post that day, and without wakening them had made an early start. This note Nada read to McKay when they sat at breakfast. "Quite frequently he has gone like that," Nada explained. "He loves the forests at night, in the light of the moon." "But last night there was no moon," said Roger.
"Yes."
"And when Father John left the cabin the sky was clouded, and it was very dark."
"You heard him go?"
"Yes, and saw him. There was a worried look in his face when he wrote that note in the candle glow."
"Roger, what do you mean?"
McKay went behind her chair and tilted up her face and kissed her shining hair and questioning eyes.
"It means, precious little wife, that Father John is hurrying to the post to get news of Breault if he can. It means that deep in his heart he wants us to follow Yellow Bird's advice to the end, for he is sure that he knows what Yellow Bird meant by the country beyond. It is the great big world outside the forests, a world so big that if need be we can put ourselves 10,000 miles away from the trails of the mounted police.
That is the thought which is urging him to the post to look for Breault. Her arms crept up to his neck, and in a little voice, trembling with eagerness, she said,
"Roger, my bundle is ready. I prepared it last night, and it is under the bed."
He held her more closely. "Are you willing to go with me anywhere?"
"Yes, anywhere."
"To the end of the earth?"
Her crumpled head nodded against his breast.
"And leave Father John?"
"Yes, for you. But I think, sometime, he will come to us."
Her fingers touched his cheek.
"And there must be forests, big, beautiful forests, in some other part of the world, Roger."
"Or a desert, where they would never think of looking for us," he laughed happily.
"I'd love the desert, Roger."
"Or an uninhabited island?" Against him, her head nodded again.
"I'd love life anywhere, with you."
"Then we'll go," he said, trying to speak very calmly in spite of the joy that was consuming him like a fire. And then he went on, steadying his voice until it was almost cold. "But it means giving up everything you've dreamed of, Nada. These forests you love, Father John, Yellow Bird, Sun Cloud."
"I have only one dream," she interrupted him softly.
"And 5 years will pass very quickly," he continued. "Possibly it will not be as bad as that, and afterward all this land we love will be free to us forever. Gladly will I remain and take my punishment if, in the end, it will make us happier, Nada."
"I have only one dream,"
she repeated, caressing his cheek with her hand,
"and that is you, Roger.
Wherever you take me, I shall be the happiest woman in the world." "Woman," he laughed, scarcely breathing the word aloud.
"Yes, I am a woman now."
"And yet, forever and ever, the little girl of Cragg's Ridge," he cried with sudden passion, crushing her close to him. "I'd lose my life sooner than I would lose her, Nada, the little girl with flying hair and strawberry stain on her nose, and who believes so faithfully in the man in the moon. Always I shall worship her as the little goddess who came down to me from somewhere in heaven." Yet all through that day, as they waited for Father John's return, he saw more and more of the wonder of woman that had come to crown the glory of Nada's wifehood, and his heart trembled with joy at the miracle of it. There was something vastly sweet in the change of her. She was no longer the utterly dependent little thing, possibly caring for him because he was big and strong and able to protect her. She was a woman, and loved him as a woman, and not because of fear or helplessness. And then came the thrilling mystery of another thing. He found himself, in turn, beginning to depend upon her, and in their planning, her calm decision and quiet reasoning strengthened him with new confidence and made his heart sing with gladness. With his eyes on the smooth and velvety coils of hair which she had twisted womanlike on her head, he said, "With your hair like that, you are my Margaret of Anjou, and the other way, with it down, you are my little Nada of Cragg's Ridge. And I don't quite understand why God should be so good to me." And this day Peter was trying in his dumb way to analyze the change. The touch of Nada's hand thrilled him, as it did a long time ago, and still he sensed the difference. Her voice was even softer when she put her cheek down to his whiskered face and talked to him, but in it he missed that which he could not quite bring back clearly through the lapse of time, the childish comradeship of her. Yet he began to worship her anew, even more fiercely than he had loved the Nada of old. He was content now to lie with his nose touching her foot or dress, but when in the sunset of early evening she went into her room, and came out a little later with her curling hair clouding her shoulders and breast, and tied with a faded ribbon she had brought from Cragg's Ridge, he danced about her, yelping joyously, and she accepted the challenge in a wild race with him to the edge of the clearing. Panting and flushed, she ran back to Jolly Roger and rested in his arms. And it was McKay, with his face half hidden in her riotous hair, who saw a figure come suddenly out of the forest at the far end of the clearing. It was Father John. He saw him pause for an instant and then stagger toward them, swaying as if about to fall. The sudden stopping of his breath, the tightening of his arms, drew Nada's shining eyes to his face, and then she too saw the little old missioner as he swayed and staggered across the clearing. With a cry she was out of McKay's arms and running toward him. Father John was leaning heavily upon her when McKay came up. His face was tense and his breath came in choking gasps, but he tried to smile as he clutched a hand at his breast.
"I have hurried," he said, making a great effort to speak calmly, "and I am winded."
He drew in a deep breath and looked at Jolly Roger.
"Roger, I have hurried to tell you. Breault is coming. He cannot be far behind me. Possibly half a mile, or a mile."
In the thickening dusk he took Nada's white face between his hands.
"I find, at last, that I was mistaken, child," he said very calmly now. "I believe it is not God's will that you remain to be taken by Breault. You must go. There is no time to lose. If Breault does not stumble off the trail in this gloom, he will be here in a few minutes. Come."
Not a word did Nada say as they went to the cabin, and McKay saw her tense face as pale as an ivory cameo in the twilight. But something in the uptilt of her chin and the poise of her head assured him that she was prepared and unafraid. In the cabin the Leaf Bud met them, and to her Nada spoke quickly. There was understanding between them, and Oosimisk dragged in a filled pack from the kitchen while Nada ran into her room and came out with the bundle. Suddenly she was standing before McKay and Father John, her breast throbbing with excitement.
"There is nothing more to make ready," she said. "Yellow Bird has been with me all this day, and her spirit told me to prepare. We have everything we need."
And then she saw only Father John, and put her arms closely about his neck, and with wide, tearless eyes looked into his face.
"Father, you will come to us?" she whispered. "You promise that?"
The missioner's arms closed about her, and he bowed his face against her lips and cheek.
"I pray God that it may be so," he said.
Nada's arms tightened convulsively, and in that moment there came a warning growl from outside the cabin door.
"Peter!"
she cried. In another moment Father John had extinguished the light.
"Go, my children!" he commanded. "You must be quick. 20 paces below the pool is a canoe. I had one of my Indians leave it there yesterday, and it is ready. Roger! Nada!"
He groped out, and the hands of the three met in the darkness.
"God bless you both. And go south, always south. Now go, go, I think I hear footsteps."
He thrust them to the door, Nada with her bundle and Roger with his pack. Suddenly he felt Peter at his side, and reaching down he fastened his fingers in the scruff of his neck and held him back.
"Goodbye," he whispered huskily. "Goodbye, Nada, Roger."
A sob came back out of the gloom.
"Goodbye, Father."
And then they listened, Peter and Father John, until the swift footsteps of the two they loved passed beyond their hearing. Peter whimpered and struggled a little, but Father John held him as he closed the door.
"It's best for you to stay, Peter," he tried to explain. "It's best for you to stay with me.
For I think they are going a far distance, and will come to a land where you would shrivel up and die.
Besides, you could not go in the canoe. So be good, and remain with me, Peter, with me."
And the Leaf Bud, standing wide-eyed and motionless, heard a strange little choking laugh come from Father John as he groped in darkness for a light. End of chapter 20. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 21 of The Country Beyond. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Country Beyond by James Oliver Curwood. Chapter 21. A slow illumination filled the cabin, first the yellow flare of a match and then the light of a lamp. And as Father John's waxen face grew out of the darkness, Peter whimpered and whined and scratched with his paws at the closed door. Usimisk, the leaf-bud, stood like a statue, with her wide, dark eyes staring at Father John, but scarcely seeming to breathe. In the old missioner's face came a trembling smile and a look of triumph as he read the fear-written question in her steady gaze. "All is well, Usimisk," he said quietly, speaking in Cree. "They are safely away and will not be caught. Continue with your duties and let no one see that anything unusual has happened. Breault will come very soon." He straightened his shoulders as if to give himself confidence and strength, and then he called Peter and comforted the dog whose master and mistress were fleeing through the dark. "They have reached the pool," he said, seating himself and holding Peter's shaggy head between his hands. "They have just about reached the pool, and Breault must be entering the clearing on the other side. Roger cannot miss the canoe, 20 paces down and with nothing to shadow it overhead. I think he has found it by this time, and in another half minute they will be off. And it is very black down the burnt wood, with deep timber close to the water, and for many miles no man can follow by night along its shores." Suddenly his hands tightened, and the leaf-bud, watching him slyly, saw the last of suspense go out of his face. "And now they are safe!" he cried exultantly. "They must be on their way, and Breault has not come across the clearing!" He rose to his feet and began pacing back and forth, while Peter sniffed yearningly at the door again. Usimisk, with the caution of her race in moments of danger, was drawing the curtains at the windows, and Father John smiled his approbation. He did not want Breault, the man-hunter, peering through one of the windows at him. Even as he walked back and forth, he listened intently for Breault's footsteps. Peter, with a sigh, gave up his scratching and settled himself on his haunches close to Nada's door. Father John, in passing him, paused to lay a hand on his head. "Some day it may please God to let us go to them," he consoled, speaking for himself even more than for Peter. "Some day, when they are far away and safe." He felt Peter suddenly stiffen under his hand, and from the leaf-bud came a low, swift word of warning. She began singing softly, and dishes and pans already clean rattled under her hands in the kitchen, and she continued to sing even as the cabin door opened and Breault, the man-hunter, stood in it. The unexpectedness of his appearance, without the sound of a warning footstep outside, was amazing even to Peter. In the open door he stood for a moment, his thin, ferret-like face standing out against the black background of the night, and his strange eyes, apparently half-closed yet bright as diamonds, sweeping the interior without effort but with the quickness of lightning. There was something deadly and foreboding about him as he stood here, and Peter growled low in his throat. Recognition flashed upon him in an instant. It was the man of the snow dune, away up on the barren, the man whom he had mistrusted from the beginning, and from whom they had fled into the face of the big storm months ago. His mind worked swiftly, even as swiftly as Breault's in its way, and without any process of reasoning, he sensed menace and enmity in this man's appearance, and associated with it the mysterious flight of Jolly Roger and Nada.
Breault had nodded without speaking. Then his eyes rested on Peter, and his face broke into a twisted sort of smile. It was not altogether unpleasant, yet was there something about it which made one shiver. It spoke the character of the man, pitiless, determined, omniscient almost, as if the spirit of a grim and unrelenting fate walked with him. Again he nodded and held out a hand.
"Peter!" he called. "Come here, Peter!"
Peter flattened his ears a fraction of an inch, but did not move. Even that fraction of an inch caught Breault's keen eyes.
"Still a one-man dog," he observed, stepping well inside the cabin and facing Father John. "Where is McKay, Father?"
He had not closed the door, and Peter saw his chance. The Leafbud saw him pass like a shot out into the night, but as he went she made no effort to call him back, for her ears were wide open as Breault repeated his question.
"Where is McKay, Father?"
Peter heard the manhunter's voice from the darkness outside. For barely an instant he paused, picking up the fresh scent of Nada and Jolly Roger. It was easy to follow, straight to the pool, and from the pool, 20 paces downstream, where a little finger of sand and pebbles had been formed by the eddies. In this bar was fresh imprint of the canoe, and here the footprints ended. Peter whimpered, peering into the tunnel of darkness between forest trees, where the water rippled and gurgled softly on its way into a deeper and more tangled wilderness. He waded belly-deep into the current, half determined to swim, and then he waited, listening intently, but could hear no sound of voice or paddle-stroke. Yet he knew Jolly Roger and Nada could not be far away. He returned to the edge of the pool and began sniffing his way downstream, pausing every 2 or 3 minutes to listen. Now and then he caught the presence of those he sought in the air, but those intervals in which he stopped to catch sound of voice or paddle lost him time, so the canoe was traveling faster than Peter. Halfway between himself and the bow of that canoe, McKay could dimly make out Nada's pale face in the star-glow that filtered like a mist through the tops of the close-hanging trees. Scarcely above his breath, he laughed in joyous confidence.
"At last my dream is coming true, Nada," he whispered. "You are mine, and we are going into another world. No one will ever find us there, no one but Father John, when we send him word. You are not afraid?"
Her voice trembled a little in the gloom.
"No, I am not afraid. But it is dark, so dark."
"The moon will be with us again in a few nights. Your moon, with the old man smiling down on us.
I know how the man in the moon must feel when he's on the other side of the world and can't see you, Nada."
Her silence made him lean toward her, striving to get a better view of her face where the starlight broke through an opening in the treetops. And in that moment he heard a little breath that was almost a sob.
"It's Peter," she said before he could speak. "Oh, Roger, why didn't we bring Peter?"
"Possibly we should have," he replied, skipping a stroke with his paddle. "But I think we have done the best thing for Peter. He is a wilderness dog, and has never known anything different. Over there, where we are going—"
"I understand. And some day Father John will bring him?"
"Yes, he has promised that. Peter will come to us when Father John comes."
She had turned, looking into the pit gloom ahead of them, so dark that the canoe seemed about to drive against a wall. Under its bow, the water gurgled like oil.
"We are entering the Big Cedar Swamp," he explained. "It's like Blind Man's Bluff, isn't it? Can you see?"
"Not beyond the bow of the canoe, Roger."
"Work back to me," he said, "very carefully."
She came obediently.
"Now turn slowly so that you face the bow, and lean back with your head against my knees.
This also she did. "This is much nicer," she whispered, nestling her head comfortably against him. "So much nicer." By leaning over until his back nearly cracked, he was able to find her lips in the darkness. "I was thinking of the brush that overhangs the stream," he explained when he had straightened himself. "Sitting up as you were, it might have caused you hurt." There was a little silence between them, in which his paddle caught again its slow and steady rhythm. Then, "Were you thinking only of the brush, Roger, and of the hurt it might cause me?"
"Yes, only of that," and he chuckled softly.
"Then I don't think it's nice here at all," she complained. "I shall sit up straight so the brush may put my eyes out."
But her head pressed even closer against him, and careful not to interrupt his paddle-stroke, she touched his face for an instant with her hand.
"It's there," she purled, as if utterly comforted. "I wanted to be sure. It's so dark."
With Cimmerian blackness on all sides of them, and a chaotic tunnel ahead, they were happy. Staring straight before him, though utterly unable to see, McKay sensed in every movement he made and in every breath he drew the exquisite thrill of a miracle, and the same thrill swept into him and through him from the softly breathing body of Nada. Light or darkness made no difference now. Together, inseparable from this time forth, they had started on the one great adventure of their lives, and for them fear had ceased to exist. The night sheltered them. Its very blackness held in its embrace a warmth of welcome and of unending hope. Twice in the next half-hour he put his hand to Nada's face, and each time she pressed her lips against it, sweet with that confidence which so completely possessed her soul. Very slowly they moved through the swamp, for because of the gloom his paddle-strokes were exceedingly short, and he was feeling his way. Frequently he ran into brush or struck the boggy shore, and occasionally Nada would hold lighted matches while he extricated the canoe from treetops and driftwood that impeded the way. He loved the brief glimpses he caught of her face in the match glow, and twice he deliberately wasted the tiny flares that he might hold the vision of her a little longer. At last he began to feel the pulse of a current against his paddle, and soon after that the star mist began filtering through the thinning treetops again, so that he knew they were almost through the swamp. Another half-hour, and they were free of it, with a clear sky overhead and the cheering song of running water on both sides of them. Nada sat up, and it was now so light that he could see the soft shimmer of her hair in the starlight. He also saw a pretty little grimace in her face, even as she smiled at him.
I can't move, she exclaimed. Ugh, my feet are asleep.
We'll go ashore and stretch ourselves, said McKay, who had looked at his watch in the light of the last match. We've 2 hours the start of Breault, and there's no other canoe.
He began watching the shore closely, and it was not long before he made out the white smoothness of a sandbar on their right. Here they landed, and for half an hour rested their cramped limbs. Then they went on, and in his heart McKay blessed the deep swamp that lay between them and Breault.
"I don't think he can make it without a canoe, even if he guesses we went this way," he explained to Nada. "And that means we are safe."
There was a cheery ring in his voice which would have changed to the deadness of cold iron could he have looked back into that sluggish pit of the burntwood through which they had come, or could he have seen into the heart of the still blacker swamp. For through the swamp, feeling his way in the black abysses and amid the monster ghosts of darkness, came Peter. And down the burntwood, between the boggy mucklips of the swamp, a man followed with slow but deadly surety, guiding with a long pole 2 light cedar timbers which he had lashed together with wire, and which bore him safely and in triumph where the canoe had gone before him. This man was Breault, the man-hunter.
"The swamp will hold him," McKay was saying again, exultantly. "Even if he guesses our way, the swamp will hold him back, Nada."
"But he won't know the way we have come,"
cried Nada, the faith in her voice answering his own. "Father John will guide him in another direction."
Back in the pit gloom, with a grim smile now and then relaxing the tight-set compression of his thin lips, and with eyes that stared like a night owl's into the gloom ahead of him, Breault pulled steadily on.
End of Chapter 21. Recording by Roger Moline.
Chapter 22 of The Country Beyond. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Country Beyond by James Oliver Curwood. Chapter 22. Dripping from the bog holes and lathered with mud, it was the mystery of Breault's noiseless presence somewhere near him in the still night that drew Peter continually deeper into the swamp. Half a dozen times he caught the scent of him in a quiet air that seemed only now and then to rise up in his face softly, as if stirred by butterflies' wings. Always it came from ahead, and Peter's mind worked swiftly to the decision that where Breault was, there also would be Nada and Jolly Roger. Yet he caught the scent of neither of these two, and that puzzled him. Many times he found himself at the edge of the black lip of water, but never quite at the right time to see a shadow in its darkness, or hear the sound of Breault's pole. But in the swamp, as he went on, he saw nothing but shadow, and heard weird and nameless sounds which made his blood creep, even though his courage was now full grown within him. He was not frightened at the ugly sputter of the owls, as in the days of old. Their throaty menace and snapping beaks did not stop him nor turn him aside. The slashing scrape of claws in the bark of trees and the occasional crackling of brush were matters of intimate knowledge, and he gave but little attention to them in his eagerness to reach those who had gone ahead of him. What troubled him, and filled his eyes with sudden red glares, were the oily gurgles of the pitfalls which tried to suck him down, the laughing madness of muck that held him as if living things were in it, and which spluttered and coughed when he freed himself. Half-blinded at times, so that even the black shadows were blotted out, he went on. And at last, coming again to the edge of the stream, he heard a new kind of sound, the slow, steady dipping of Breault's pole. He hurried on, finding harder ground under his feet, and came noiselessly abreast of the man on his raft of cedar timbers. He could almost hear his breathing, and very faintly he could see in the vast gloom a shadow that moved slowly against the background of a still deeper shadow beyond. But there was no scent of Nada or Jolly Roger, and whatever desire had risen in him to make himself known was smothered by caution and suspicion. After this he did not go ahead of Breault, but kept behind him or abreast of him, within sound of the dipping pole. And every minute his heart thumped expectantly, and he sniffed the new air for signs of those he most desired to find. Dawn was breaking in the sky when they came out of the swamp, and the first flush of the sun was lighting up the east, when Breault headed his improvised craft for the sandbar upon which Nada and McKay had rested many hours before. Breault was tired, but his eyes lighted up when he saw the footprints in the sand, and he chuckled, almost good-humoredly. As a matter of fact, he was in a good humor, but one would not have reckoned it as such in Breault. A hard man, the forests called him, a man with the hunting instincts of the fox and the wolf, and the merciless persistency of the weasel, a man who lived his code to the last letter of the law, without pity and without favoritism. At least, so he was judged, and his hard, narrow eyes, his thin lips, and his cynically lined face
seldom betrayed the better thoughts within him, if he possessed any at all. In the service he was regarded as a humanly perfect mechanism, a bit of machinery that never failed, the dreaded nemesis to be set on the trail of a wrongdoer when all others had failed. But this morning, with every bone and muscle in him aching from his long night of tedious exertion, the chuckle grew into a laugh as he looked upon the telltale signs in the sand. He stretched himself, and his tired bones cracked. Breault did not think aloud, but he was saying to himself, "There, against that rock, Jolly Roger McKay sat. There is the imprint of only one person sitting. The girl was in his arms. Here are little holes where her outstretched heels rested in the sand. She is wearing shoes and not moccasins." He grinned as he drew his service pack from the two-log cedar raft. "Plenty of time now," he continued to think. "They are mine this time, sure. They believe they have fooled me, and they haven't. That's fatal, always." Not infrequently, when entirely alone, Breault let a little part of himself loose, as if freeing a prisoner from bondage for a short time. For instance, he whistled. It was not an unpleasant whistle, but rather oddly reminiscent of tender things he remembered away back somewhere. And as he fried his bacon and steamed a handful of desiccated potatoes, he hummed a song, also rather pleasant to ears that were as closely attentive as Peter's. For Peter had crept up through a tangle of ground scrub and lay not 20 paces away, smelling of the bacon hungrily and watching intently from his concealment. Peter knew the fox and the wolf, but he did not know Breault, and he did not guess why the man's whistling grew a little louder, nor why his humming voice grew stronger. But after a time, with his back and not his face toward Peter, Breault called in the most natural and matter-of-fact voice in the world, "Come on, Peter, breakfast is ready." Peter's jaws dropped in amazement, and as Breault turned toward him, his thin face a grin, and continued to invite him in a most companionable way, he forgot his concealment entirely and stood up straight, ready either to fight or fly. Breault tossed him a dripping slice of bacon which he held in his hand. It fell within a foot of Peter's nose, and Peter was ravenously hungry. The delicious odor of it demoralized his senses and his caution. For a few seconds he resisted, then thrust himself out toward it an inch at a time, made a sudden grab, and swallowed it at one gulp. Breault laughed outright, and with the first of the sun striking into his face, he did not look like an enemy to Peter. A second slice of bacon followed the first, and then a third, until Breault was frying another mess over the fire. "That's partial payment for what you did up on the Barren," he was saying inside himself. "If it hadn't been for you..." He didn't even imagine the rest. Nor after that did he pay the slightest attention to Peter. For Breault knew dogs possibly even better than he knew men, and not by the smallest sign did he give Peter to understand that he was interested in him at all. He washed his dishes, whistling and humming, reloaded his pack and the raft, and once more began poling his way downstream. Peter, still in the edge of the scrub, was not only puzzled, but felt a further sense of abandonment. After all, this man was not his enemy, and he was leaving him as his master and mistress had left him. He whined, and Breault was not out of sight when he trotted down to the sandbar and quickly found the scent of Nada and McKay. Purposely, Breault had left a lump of desiccated potato as big as his fist, and this Peter ate as ravenously as he had eaten the bacon. Then, just as Breault knew he would do, he began following the raft. Breault did not hurry, and he did not rest. There was something almost mechanically certain in his slow but steady progress, though he knew it was possible for the canoe to outdistance him 3-1.
He was missing nothing along the shore. 3 times during the forenoon he saw where the canoe had landed, and he chuckled each time, thinking of the old story of the tortoise and the hare. He stopped for not more than 2 or 3 minutes at each of these places, and was then on his way again. Peter was fascinated by the unexcited persistency of the man's movement. He followed it, watched it, and became more and more interested in the unvarying monotony of it. There were the same up-and-down strokes of the long pole, the slight swaying of the upstanding body, the same eddy behind the cedar logs, and occasionally wisps of smoke floating behind when the pursuer smoked his pipe. Not once did Peter see Breault turn his head to look behind him. Yet Breault was seeing everything. 5 times that morning he saw Peter, but not once did he make a sign or call to him. He drove his raft ashore at 12 o'clock to prepare his dinner, and after he had built a fire and his cooking things were scattered about, he straightened himself up and called in that same matter-of-fact way, as if expecting an immediate response. "Here, Peter! Peter, come in, boy!" And Peter came. Fighting against the last instinct that held him back, he first thrust his head out from the brush and looked at Breault. Breault paid no attention to him for a few moments, but sliced his bacon. When the perfume of the cooking meat reached Peter's nose, he edged himself a little nearer, and with a whimpering sigh flattened himself on his belly. Breault heard the sigh and grunted a reply.
"Hungry again, Peter?" he inquired casually.
He had saved for this moment a piece of cooked bacon held over from breakfast, and tearing this with his finger, he tossed the strips to Peter. As he did this, he was thinking to himself,
"Why am I doing this? I don't want the dog. He'll be a nuisance. He'll eat my grub. But it's fair. I'm paying a debt. He helped to save me up on the barren."
Thus did Breault, the man without mercy, the nemesis, briefly analyze the matter. And he cooked 5 pieces of bacon for Peter. During the rest of that day, Peter made no effort to keep himself in concealment as he followed Breault and his raft. This afternoon Breault shot a fawn, and when he made camp that night both he and Peter feasted on fresh meat. This broke down the last of Peter's suspicion, and Breault laid a hand on his head. He did not particularly like the feel of the hand, but he tolerated it, and Breault grunted aloud, with a note of condemnation in his hard voice,
"A one-man dog, never anything else."
6 times during the day Peter had found the scent of Nada and Roger where they had come ashore, and from this night on he associated Breault as a necessary agent in his search for them. And with Breault he went, instinctively guessing the truth. The next day they found where Nada and McKay had abandoned the canoe, and had struck south through the wilderness. This pleased Breault, who was tired of his poling. This third night there was a new moon, and something about it stirred in Peter an impulse to run ahead and overtake those he was seeking. But a still strong instinct held him to Breault. Tonight Breault slept like a dead man on his cedar boughs. He was up and had a fire built an hour before dawn, and with the first gray streaking of day was on the trail again. He made no further effort to follow signs of the pursued, for that was a hopeless task. But he knew how McKay was heading, and he traveled swiftly, figuring to cover twice the distance that Nada might travel in the same given time. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon when he came to a great ridge, and on its highest pinnacle he stopped. Peter had grown restless again, and a little more suspicious of Breault. He was not afraid of him, but all that day he had found no scent of Nada or Jolly Roger, and slowly the conviction was impinging itself upon him that he should seek for himself in the wilderness. Breault saw this restlessness and understood it.
"I'll keep my eye on the dog," he thought. "He has a nose and an uncanny sixth sense, and I haven't either. He will bear watching. I believe McKay and the girl cannot be far away. Possibly they have traveled more slowly than I thought, and haven't passed this ridge. Or it may be they are down there, in the plain. If so, I should catch sign of smoke or fire in time." For an hour he kept watch over the plain through his binoculars, seeking for a wisp of smoke that might rise at any time over the treetops. He did not lose sight of Peter, questing out in widening circles below him. And then, quite unexpectedly, something happened. In the edge of a tiny meadow, an eighth of a mile away, Peter was acting strangely. He was nosing the ground, gulping the wind, twisting eagerly back and forth. Then he set out, steadily and with unmistakable decision, south and west. In a flash, Breault was on his feet, had caught up his pack, and was running for the meadow. And there he found something in the velvety softness of the earth which brought a grim smile to his thin lips as he, too, set out south and west. The scent he had found, hours old, drew Peter on until, in the edge of the dusk of evening, it brought him to a foot-worn trail leading to the Hudson's Bay Company post many miles south. In this path, beaten by the feet of generations of forest dwellers, the hard heels of McKay's boots had made their imprint, and after this the scent was clearer under Peter's nose. But with forest-bred caution he still traveled slowly, though his blood was burning like a pitch-fed fire in his veins. Almost as swiftly followed Breault behind him. Again came darkness, and then the moon, brighter than last night, lighting his way between the two walls of the forest. End of chapter 22. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 23 of The Country Beyond. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. The Country Beyond by James Oliver Curwood. Chapter 23. Dawn came softly where the quiet waters of the willow bud ran under deep forests of evergreen out into the gold and silver birch of the Nelson River flats. A veiling mist rose out of the earth to meet the promise of day, gentle and sweet, like scented raiment, stirring sleepily to the pulse of an awakening earth. Through it came the first low twitter of birdsong, a sound that seemed to swell and grow until it filled the world. Yet was it still a sound of sleep, of half-wakefulness, and the mist was thinning away when a ruffled little breast sent out its full-throat song from the tip of a silver birch that overhung the stream. The little warbler was looking down, as if wondering why there was no stir of life beneath him, where in last night's sunset there had been much to wonder at, and a new kind of song to thrill him. But the girl was no longer there to sing back at him. The cedar and balsam shelter dripped with morning dew, the place where fire had been was black and dead, and ruffling his feathers the warbler continued his song in triumph. Nada, hidden under her shelter, and still half-dreaming, heard him. She lay with her head nestled in the crook of Roger's arm, and the bird-song seemed to come to her from a great distance away. She smiled, and her lips trembled as if, even in sleep, she was about to answer it. And then the song drifted away until she could no longer hear it, and she sank back into an oblivion of darkness in which she seemed lost for a long time, and out of which some invisible force was struggling to drag her. There came at last a sudden irresistible pull at her senses, and she opened her eyes, awake. Her head was no longer in the crook of Jolly Roger's arm. She could see him sitting up straight, and he was not looking at her. It must be late, she thought, for the light was strong in his face, warm with the first golden flow of the sun.
She smiled and sat up and shook her soft curls with a happy little laugh.
"Roger!"
And then she, too, was staring, wide-eyed and speechless, for she saw Peter under Jolly Roger's hand. But it was not Peter who drew her breath short and sent fear cutting like a sharp knife through her heart. Facing them, seated coldly on a log which McKay had dragged in from the timber, was a thin-faced, sharp-eyed man who was studying them with an odd smile on his lips, and instantly Nada knew this man was Breault. There was something peculiarly appalling about him as he sat there, in spite of the fact that for a few moments he neither spoke nor moved. His eyes, Nada thought, were not like human eyes, and his lips were like the blades of two knives set together. Yet he was smiling, or half-smiling, not in a comforting or humorous way, but with exultation and triumph. From looking at him, one would never have guessed that Breault loved his joke. He nodded. "Good morning, Jolly Roger McKay. And good morning, Mrs. Jolly Roger McKay. Pardon me for watching you like this, but duty is duty. I am Breault, of the Royal Northwest Mounted Police." McKay wet his lips. Breault saw him, and the grin on his thin face widened. "I know, it's hard," he said, "but you've got Peter to thank for it. Peter led me to you." He stood up, and in a most casual fashion covered Jolly Roger with his automatic. "Would you mind stepping out, McKay?" he asked. In his other hand he dangled a pair of handcuffs. McKay stood up, and Nada rose beside him, gripping his arms with both hands. "No need of those things, Breault," he said. "I'll go peaceably." "Still, it's safer," argued Breault, a wicked glitter in his eyes. "Hold out one hand, please." The manacle snapped over Jolly Roger's wrist. "I'm Breault, not Terence Cassidy," he chuckled. "Never take a chance, you know. Never." Swift as a flash was his movement then, as the companion bracelet snapped over Nada's wrist. He stepped back, facing them with a grin. "Got you both now, haven't I?" he gloated. "Can't get away, can you?" He put his gun away and bowed low to Nada. "How do you like married life, Mrs. Jolly Roger?" McKay's face was whiter than Nada's. "You coward!" he spoke in a low, quiet voice. "You low-down, miserable coward! You're a disgrace to the service! Do you mean you're going to keep my wife ironed like this?"
"Sure," said Breault. "I'm going to make you pay for some of the trouble I've had over you. I believe in a man paying his debts, you know. And a woman, too. And probably you've lied to her like the very devil."
"He hasn't," protested Nada fiercely. "You're a...
"Say it," nodded Breault good-humoredly. "By all means, say it, Mrs. Jolly Roger. If you can't find words, let me help you."
And while he waited, he loaded his pipe and lighted it.
"You see, I don't exactly live up to regulations when I'm with good friends like you," he apologized cynically. "In other words, you're a couple of hard cases. Cassidy has turned in all sorts of evidence about you. He says that you, McKay, should be hung the moment we catch you. He warned me not to take a chance, that you'd slit my throat in the dark without a prick of conscience. And I'm a valuable man in the service. It can't afford to lose me."
McKay shut his lips tightly and did not answer.
"Now, while you're helpless, I want to tell you a few things," Breault went on. "And while I'm talking, I'll start the fire so we can have breakfast. Peter and I are hungry. A good dog, McKay. He saved us up on the Barren. Have you told Mrs. Jolly Roger about that?"
He expected no answer, and whistled as he lighted a pile of birch bark which he had already placed under dry cedar wood which McKay had gathered the preceding evening.
"That's where my trouble began, up there on the barren, Mrs. Jolly Roger," he continued, ignoring McKay. "You see, the three of us, Superintendent Tavish and Porter, who is now his son-in-law, and I, had a splendid chance to die like martyrs, and go down forever in the history of the service, if it hadn't been for this fool of a husband of yours, and Peter. I can't blame Peter, because he's only a dog. But McKay is responsible. He robbed us of a beautiful opportunity of dying in an unusual way, by hunting us up and dragging us into his shelter. A shabby trick, don't you think? And inasmuch as Superintendent Tavish is about the biggest man in the service, and Porter is his son-in-law, and Miss Tavish was saved along with us, why, they reckon something ought to be done about it."
Breault did not look up. With exasperating slowness, he added fuel to the fire.
"And so," he rose and stood before them again, "and so, they assigned me to the very unpleasant duty of running you down with a pardon, McKay, a pardon forgiving you for all your sins, forever and ever, amen. And here it is."
He had drawn an official-looking envelope from inside his coat and held it out now, not to McKay, but to Nada. Neither reached for it. Standing there with a cynical smile still on his lips, his strange eyes gimleting them with a cold sort of laughter, it was as if Breault tortured them with a last horrible joke. Then, suddenly, Nada seized the envelope and tore it open, while McKay stared at Breault, believing and yet not daring to speak. It was Nada's cry, a cry wild and sobbing and filled with gladness, that told him the truth, and with the precious paper clutched in her hand, she smothered her face against McKay's breast, while Breault came up grinning behind them, and Jolly Roger heard the click of his key in the handcuffs.
"I am also loaded with a number of foolish messages for you," he said, attending to the fire again. "For instance, that red-headed good-for-nothing Cassidy says to tell you he's building a four-room bungalow for you in their clearing, and that it'll be finished by the time you arrive. Also, a squaw named Yellowbird, and a redskin who calls himself Slim Buck, sent word that you will always be welcome in their hunting grounds. And a pretty little thing named Suncloud sent as many kisses as there are leaves on the trees."
He paused, chuckling, and did not look up to see the wide, glorious eyes of the girl upon him.
"But the funniest thing of all is the baby," he went on, preparing to slice bacon. "They're going to have one pretty soon, Cassidy's wife, I mean. They've given it a name already. If it's a boy, it's Roger. If it's a girl, it's Nada. They wanted me to tell you that. Silly bunch, aren't they? A couple of young fools."
Just then something new happened in the weirdly adventurous life of Francois Breault. Without warning he was suddenly smothered in a pair of arms, his head was jerked back, and against his hard and pitiless mouth a pair of soft red lips pressed for a single thrilling instant.
"Well, I'll be damned!"
he gasped, dropping his bacon and staggering to his feet like a man who had been shot.
"I'll be cussed!"
And he picked up his pack and walked off into the thick young spruce at the edge of the timber, without saying another word or once looking behind him. And breakfast waited, and Nada and Jolly Roger and Peter waited, but Francois Breault did not return. For a strange and unaccountable man was he, a hard and pitiless man, and a deadly hunter who knew no fear. Yet the wilderness swallowed him, a coward at last, running away from the two red lips that had kissed him. So went Breault, for the first time in his life a messenger of mercy, and at the top of the silver birch the little warbler knew that something glad had happened,
and offered up its gratitude in a sudden burst of song. The End. End of Chapter 23. Recording by Roger Moline. End of The Country Beyond by James Oliver Curwood.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.